The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
With me, I have Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway, Miriam Simon, business strategist, and Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin. And it is with matters relating to Sinn Féin, of course, that we will start. We saw, and we were talking to Sean Defoe there before the break, about the resignation of Brian Stanley from Sinn Féin and the excoriating statement that he put out, including allegations like, after 40 years of service to Sinn Féin, I will now continue working as an independent Republican TD on behalf of constituents who have always treated me in a fair and respectful manner. In recent months, a certain clique within the party have gone to extreme lengths to damage my reputation and character. No efforts have been spared by them in this regard. Lynn, if you have the resignation of somebody who was a celebrity parachute candidate and was there a wet week, it isn't that damaging. Brian Stanley is something of a stalwart.
No, look, it's always sad to see someone leave the party. Do you know what I mean? Especially someone, as you said, who's been a long time with us. And it's like, it's not a good news to wake up on a Sunday morning to hear that Brian Stanley's left. But there is, I suppose, checks and balances and processes when you're a member of an organisation. And there was an investigation ongoing. Brian has decided to leave before that process was concluded. During that entire investigation, his barrister and his solicitor were present at the meetings. So that's disappointing that he didn't allow the process to continue.
What is the process?
To finish. Well, that it's an internal process in terms of if an allegation is made against somebody, you know, you'll go in like any organisation has and you'll answer questions. But like at all stages, Brian was represented by his barrister and his solicitor. So it's deeply disingenuous and very loaded for him to talk about kangaroo courts. We're all subject to rules when you're a member of an organisation and a political party.
Does Sinn Féin make those rules public?
I believe they are public. There was a big, we revised all of the rules a number of years ago at the Ardèche. So they were there, they were debated and publicly put out. As all political parties will do, you'll look back and you'll review and amend and reform as processes come along.
But as in the nature of that disciplinary procedure, that is in the public domain, Sinn Féin says this is how we deal with
these
complaints.
I would imagine it is because it was debated at the Ardèche a couple of years back, yeah.
And what Brian Stanley is saying is that it was it lacked objectivity, it was seriously flawed and devoid of impartiality. And it's interesting that throughout he refers to the inquiry in inverted commas, this inquiry has been shown to lack any shred of credibility, not least due to a significant abuse of process.
Well, look, Anton, I don't know what the nature of the allegation was against Brian. He has more information than I do. But what I do know is that there is a disciplinary procedure within the party if allegations are made. And that is right. Do you know what I mean? If we didn't do act on that, then we would be here trying to answer other questions. So that's the process that's in place. And, you know, if somebody is represented by their barrister and their solicitor, they can't say that there wasn't due process or a lack of transparency. I mean, they were legally represented at that disciplinary procedure.
But one doesn't necessarily define the other. The fact that you have a barrister and a solicitor present does not mean that you are subject to a fair process. It means you have legal representation, but you might be legally represented in an unfair process.
But he hasn't allowed the process to conclude. So make of that what you will, where he thought maybe the process was going. That's for Brian to answer. But as I said, I don't know what the allegation was. I imagine it was quite serious. If someone brings a barrister and a solicitor to a meeting, it must be a serious allegation. But I don't have that full facts and information. But I'm a member of Sinn Féin. I'm an elected rep. You know, there are procedures in place. Like if you're a member of a football club or a sporting club or anything, there are rules around membership of organisations, and all organisations have processes in place that if somebody is seen to either breach those rules or to not, I suppose, represent the standards of that organisation, then there has to be a process in place to question that person and to allow them to defend themselves as well.
What of the slightly odd situation that, given that the party has called for transparency in matters of public office repeatedly over, and rightly over, recent years, and Brian Stanley himself has been in a role where his job has been to investigate and seek transparency in matters public in the PAC, but neither side has told the public what this complaint is?
Well, that's not for me to say. As I said, I don't know what the nature of the complaint is. Brian could end all of this today and actually could tell people what he was being investigated for, if he felt so hard done by in terms of that process, well, then maybe he needs to be honest and say, this is what the allegation was. This clique or whatever he's referring to, you know, who are members of the party or against him, then that's up to Brian. Brian could clear this situation up with a tweet if he wanted to. He could just tell us what was he being investigated for, if he's completely convinced, I mean, that there wasn't due process.
Now, there are two separate sides, because you mentioned the clique. One is whether or not due process was applied. And he is very clearly saying that in his view, this was a partial process and that it was a process where there wasn't fairness and objectivity throughout. Separate to that, he's alleging that there has been a vendetta ongoing for some time. This thing of a clique within the party has gone to extreme lengths to damage my reputation and character. No efforts have been spared by them in this regard. And he says that it has been going on, he says, in recent months. So for an extended period of time. Have you any insight into what that might
be? But again, he's throwing out accusations, but not giving any substance as to what the nature of those accusations are. So that's, I suppose, very unfair then, when you've got one hand tied behind your back, to be saying, that is there any merit to what he's saying? It's two sides here. So Brian could absolutely clear this up if he gave some context to what was this so-called vendetta that he's referring to. Who's the so-called clique? Was it just people that he didn't happen to get on with in an area? And what was the nature of the investigation? He could do all of that. He could clear all of that up today if he wants to. But to just throw out accusations and not allow a process to conclude makes it very difficult then, because I can't say what he was being investigated for.
Are you surprised that somebody who is so long a party member, I mean, 40 years commitment to the party, to get to a position where he's saying that he has lost confidence in the party in its totality, are you surprised that it would get that far?
Look, it's very disappointing. Nobody likes to see elected reps step down. Nobody likes to see long-standing party members leave. But the nature of politics is disagreements happen. Politics is a blood sport. Do you know what I mean? People fall out. They have disputes over boundaries. They have disputes over conventions. They have disputes over policy. That is the nature of politics. But as I said, it's disappointing that Brian has left. It's disappointing that he's put out half a story. So I think if he really believes and is adamant about his version of events, then he should probably give some more details about what the nature of the allegations were.
Explain what you mean by putting out half a story.
Well, he's saying that there was no transparency. He's saying there was a vendetta. He's saying there was a clique against him, but he's not making any reference to what the nature of those actions were.
Let me bring in you, Larry Donnelly, on the political implications of this, because one of the things has been, there has been something of a drip or a death by a thousand cuts or whatever cliche you want to apply for Sinn Féin in recent times. And it has struggled somewhat to reverse that drip and get the momentum back. Is this going to further their electoral problems as we head for an election?
I think it could well. I was struck by a quote from a senior Sinn Féin source in a piece in the Sunday Times relating to what's happened in the North and the references that were written for someone under very serious charges of child sex crimes, etc. And he said that, or she said that, this is the last thing we need. And now in the wake of the resignation first of Patricia Ryan, is that the last thing we need? And now to take it up a big notch, this is not some backbencher. This is the chair of the Public Accounts Committee. This is somebody who has been in Sinn Féin for decades and been a TD for a long time. For him to walk, this is the absolute last thing the party needs. And let's face it, it comes against a political backdrop where since immigration emerged as an issue on the scene, and since at least it was perceived by some of its core supporters to be cozying up to the establishment in inverted commas, Sinn Féin has been unmoored. That backing they had, I think, largely on foot of the housing issue and Owen O'Brien's advocacy on the housing issue, that came apart. And they've been betwixt in between ever since then. So it's amazing what a year can do in politics. A year ago, Sinn Féin was in the mid-30s in the polls. Mary Lou McDonald was the most popular leader in the state. Very hard to see now.
And I should say, by the way, that as to you talk about whether this is the last thing we need, the other thing that is in Brian Stanley's statement, which may cause further problems, is he has an ominous single sentence which says, "Legal examination of this matter will continue," which suggests that Brian Stanley isn't it doesn't regard this as an absolutely closed matter. I should say, by the way, that Lynn Boylan was booked to join us on the panel this morning previous to this breaking overnight and isn't here to act as official spokesperson on this matter. We have asked Sinn Féin for a statement, as has our newsroom for some time. So far, nothing is forthcoming. But obviously, if the party wants to send us in something
just
official.
On that, I do understand Mary Lou will be making a statement this afternoon.
This afternoon is when we're going to hear something official. Okay, so Sinn Féin President Mary Lou McDonald to speak this afternoon. Press conference, is that the plan?
I'm not sure. I think I actually think she's in Sligo as well. But I've just been informed that there will be a statement made today.
Did you get any further detail beyond that we should be made aware of?
I have the same information as you, Anton.
53106 at a cost of 30 cents. If you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. We may return to that matter as we go on. Before that, we will turn to US politics, because we are getting ever closer to the election across the water. And like recent American elections, it is getting ever more bizarre, because we have the Democrats sort of ploughing the relatively traditional political furrow, and we have Donald Trump using the opportunity to run for president as a way to flog watches in this ad.
It's your favorite president, Donald J. Trump, here to introduce something really special. I think you're going to love it. My new Trump watches. This isn't just any watch. It's one of the best watches made, with almost 200 grams of gold and more than 100 real diamonds. That's a lot of diamonds. I love gold. I love diamonds. We all do. Owning one puts you in a very exclusive club. Get your Trump watch right now. Go to gettrumpwatches.com. It's Trump time.
Now, just to be clear, that isn't parody. That is a genuine ad for Trump watches that is currently running in the US. Miriam Simon, business strategist. Let's start with the retail aspect. Is he going to make a fortune?
Can I just say, they're limited edition notch. And they're retailing at about 100 grand each.
Although there's a broad spectrum. You can get them cheaper if you want them cheaper.
There's a $500 takedown version, but the limited edition ones are about 100K US dollars each. But you get a personal letter from Trump. So, he's making hay while the sun shines.
And what's interesting and worth stating in this is the immediate reaction to hearing that might be to assume that this is political fundraising for the campaign. My understanding is this is entirely separate from the campaign. Any money that derives from this goes to Donald.
No, this is wheeler dealering. This is back pocket stuff, I think. Yeah, this is wheeler dealering.
Larry, you have been analysing US politics for some time. Did you ever think on the eve of an election you would be analysing watch ads as part of it?
No, I never did. And look, it's another example of Trump. And, you know, look, Trump plays the game by different rules to anybody else. He is not held to the same standards on anything, because his political support remains intact no matter what. I don't want to go all deep sociological here. I'd rather stick to the nitty gritty of politics. But the fact that he is where he is indicative, unfortunately, of a society that is broken, of a model, economic model that is broken. And the fact that Donald Trump ever won the Republican nomination in 2016, I fear, is sad evidence of that. Were things okay with America? A place I know you've spent a lot of time recently. Were things okay with America? Donald Trump never would have gotten to the position where he is. Unfortunately, because of a whole variety of factors, again, we don't have the time to get into it, we are where we are, and Donald Trump's a Republican nominee.
You mentioned that thing of having spent some time there recently. I traveled half the Rust Belt and a lot of the border counties, or states rather, and two things struck me. One was the chasm between rich and poor. We talk a lot in all Western countries about the divide between rich and poor, but abject, endemic, insoluble poverty, and usually then that leads to, I think, because you can argue cause and effect, but leads to the kind of opioid problems that we have. And then you travel 300 miles down the road and you have wealth beyond the dreams of Croesus. It's interesting, though, that these are not the issues that are being talked about in much of the campaign. Even the Democrats aren't particularly focused on those kind of things.
No, I mean, the election has kind of been an issue-free zone in many respects. I think, to her credit, Kamala Harris has devised a few plans on the inflation cost of living issue, which I think are reasonably good and tailored in the right direction. But the thing is, Trump has convinced such a vast swathe of the population that he does care for them, that he's a, and he's actually speaking to them. That's the one thing he is doing. He is speaking to them, whether he is lying to them or whatever, he is talking to them. And it has been a grievous failure by Republicans and Democrats alike not to talk about this. I always give the example of hearing Barack Obama give a speech. I can't remember what convention it was. And it was uplifting. It was wonderful. You know, the usual Obama. But I'm thinking to myself, how hollow does that ring if you're an unemployed steel worker in Pennsylvania? It doesn't make any sense when this guy keeps saying our best days are in front of us. We have all these good things going. Trump came along with a very different message, spotted the discontent, spotted the inequality, targeted his message absolutely perfectly. And again, that's why he is where he is.
And on that thing of inequality, the other thing, of course, that is so significant is the racial divide. And to some extent, it is being played upon, whether positively or negatively, by the Democrats, because they have always had an 80% black vote for the last 20 or 30 years, maybe even more than that. Barack Obama recently, just outside one of the conventions, was pitching directly to black male voters, trying to get them to come out on race grounds for Kamala Harris.
My understanding, based on reports I'm getting from campaigns and communities, is that we have not yet seen the same kinds of energy and turnout in all quarters of our neighborhoods and communities as we saw when I was running. I also want to say that that seems to be more pronounced with the brothers.
That, Limboyne, goes to an interesting challenge for Kamala Harris. There was a sense, particularly on the, after the announcement of Tim Ryan as the VP, there was a great sense of momentum and excitement about her campaign. Is it me or is that waning?
I think it is waning now, obviously observing it from the outside, looking in. But I think that the problems in America are so deep-rooted, the divisions, the polarization of politics, and it's actually very sad to see. The inequality is a key part of it. I mean, this is late-stage capitalism. This is what happens when you have the type of economic model that the US has, that the EU is trying to pursue as well, which is, you know, you just pull yourself up by the bootstraps and then anybody who can't survive or in that sort of economic system are just left by the wayside. So it's going to take more than this election cycle to fix that. I don't think it's too close to call. I think there's a good chance that we will have Trump back in the Oval Office for another 4 years. But it's the long term impacts of this is really, really concerning. And you're seeing that polarisation now happening across the water in Britain. You're seeing it in the European Union and the European Parliament. So it's something that all of us as politicians have to take, but addressing inequality, addressing the flaws of the economic model have to be part of that.
Does it, I don't mean this facetiously, does it matter who wins if that underlying polarity remains? I mean, if you have a nation that is so utterly divided, this sort of sense among the centre-left that if Kamala Harris is elected, well, that solves the problems. Doesn't really make any difference.
No, absolutely not. It doesn't. I mean, we've had 4 years of Biden and it hasn't solved the problems. I mean, the problems have gotten worse. It's much more deep-rooted than that. And that's what's really, I suppose, concerning for all of us looking on and how it's been replicated across. I think we're in for choppy waters across the world for the next probably decade.
What about that, Larry? How do you solve that problem? Because from the early 80s and the deregulation of media in the US, all you've had is that gap getting wider and wider and wider and more angry. How do you ever tie it back together?
It's very difficult. You know, when you have that media landscape as poison as it is in the United States, it's very difficult to fix, in particular because of the First Amendment and the way that the First Amendment speech clause has been interpreted by the courts over many, many years, including the fact that money in the form of campaign contributions is entitled to First Amendment protection, which has engulfed the system and ruined the system in many respects. I think it's going to cost $10 billion to run for president this year. But to bring it back to...
Is that how much money goes into a presidential campaign? $10 billion?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. Wow. Massive. So, you know, just to go back to what Lynn was saying, you know, about whether it matters, I think it's a little bit nihilist to say that it doesn't matter. I think it does matter, especially when you have somebody who, in my view, could pose a clear and present danger to lots of things in the United States and around the world as Donald Trump. So I do think it matters. But I am today a little bit downbeat, you know, about Kamala Harris's chances of winning. And I say that because Unfortunately, I think we're getting to see this. She's not a strong candidate. She's poor on her feet. She's easily exposed. The fact is, if there was a competitive primary process, she would not have come through it, in my opinion. Somebody else would be the nominee right now. I also think she's a victim of something a little bit beyond her control, in the sense that, are you better off for now than you were 4 years ago? For most Americans, that's not true. And Harris indeed has foolishly said there's nothing she would change about how Biden did business, which had to have her people saying, what are you doing?
That's a difficult knife edge for her to walk, though, because you can't throw him totally under the bus.
Of course it is. But when she said there's not a thing I would change, that's a big mistake. And the last thing, and again, people here take issue with this and take issue when I say it, but what I keep hearing, and I think is coming through over and over again, is that Harris is just too far to the left, particularly on cultural issues for America, especially the way the Electoral College maths add up, that she simply doesn't connect. She's at variance with so many Americans, including, I should say, the fastest growing demographic in the United States, Latinos. Trump is polling in the mid-40s with Latinos. If that number holds up, I don't see how Harris can win the thing.
After the break, we're going to be talking about the day of action that is planned in respect of the hospitality hospitality sector, because Adrian Cummins, CEO of the Restaurant Association, will be with us, a sector that has said that it hasn't been looked after properly in the recent budget and that's been suffering because of both cost and inflation rises and, of course, the VAT impact on it. By the way, I should have said earlier on, not only do we have a request in with Sinn Féin, we do, of course, have requests in for Brian Stanley. And if he wishes to join us on the programme, he would be more than welcome.
And Anton, I hope you have requests in for all the Fine Gaelers as well, who've defected and running as independents between Kate O'Connell and the councillor in Wicklow.
If they choose to resign overnight, they are more than welcome.
Or Senator Pat Casey, who was thrown under the bus by Stephen Donnelly's campaign as well. This is the nature of politics.
In a second, we're going to be talking to Adrian Cummins, who is CEO of the Restaurant Association, because of a protest that they are undertaking to try to get attention to how much the sector is struggling. Miriam, give us a sense from your perspective of how much the sector actually is struggling.
We're actually at a really critical tipping point, not just for hospitality and vintners, but actually also for retail. I was talking to Jean McCabe during the week, and we've seen unprecedented closures in Indigenous retail this year, as well as in Indigenous hospitality businesses. So just to give a bit of context around it, the recent budget did not appear to be one that was very pro SME business. So minimum wage has gone up about 25% in the last few years, which is an impact to small businesses. Add on top of that the debt warehousing and a situation where our banking sector is no longer competitive, which means also not very helpful for a lot of small businesses. Then we have heat, light and power and food inflation that has been off the scale the last few years, unprecedented. And these were low cost commodities that we've all, even as individuals, taken for granted until recent years. So, you know, add on to all of that, the new sick pay, the new auto pension enrolment, the cost of doing business is so exceptionally high that why would you do business?
Now, is that the same across all SMEs in your view, or is it particularly onerous on the hospitality sector?
It's very onerous on restaurateurs, but it's also very onerous on all business, actually. Retailers are having the same difficulty. So we have a business community across both that are not feeling very supported by the recent budget. And actually, the fact of the matter is we are losing our Indigenous restaurateurs, because you need to be a big chain and you need to have the scale of being a big chain in order to be able to survive the cost of doing business. And similarly, we're seeing similarly across retail too. So unfortunately, we're in a situation where I think there's maybe a perception because of the hotel industry, you know, the cost of staying in Ireland is now expensive. So there's a perception that in the hotel industry, businesses are doing very well. But the other side of that is restaurateurs, where they are really pinned to the mast now.
Well, let's bring in Adrian Cummins on that note. First of all, Adrian, the protest demonstration, however you want to characterise it, what is it that you have planned?
Good morning, Anton. What we have planned on behalf of the hospitality sector is a rally stroke protest that will start at 1 o'clock at the Pepper Canister Church, Bond Street, where we'll assemble, and then we'll march towards the Dáil, and we'll assemble outside Moses Street in front of the Dáil around 2:15, where we'll outline our issues, and many, many business owners will be on stage talking about their issues and how their backs are against the wall, and in essence, in terms of trying to survive. I think Miriam has pointed out quite correctly, there is a major issue within our sector in terms of the cost of business. The budget didn't deliver for us. It was a measly 4,000 euros. It wasn't targeted towards our sector. And we're listening on the other side that the government are in support of small business. The government have the backs of small business. The Taoiseach says there's an issue around cafes and restaurants and we'll support them. But there's no, it doesn't seem to be any targeted support for our industry. So that has angered our sector, and hence we've never had a protest before like this. This is something that's new to our industry, but we feel that we have to do it. We have to voice our opinion. And in fairness to other sectors that are in affected, like retail, like childcare, nursing homes, hardware, all of these other sectors are joining us on the march next week in solidarity with us. So there is an issue out there now around small business. We want to highlight to the forefront with the government. And we were looking for an urgent meeting with the government to sit down with them to say, what are you going to do for us?
And, and to some extent, Adrian, though, has the ship not sailed? If they were going to do anything, wouldn't they do it during the budget?
Well, you can say that, but sometimes when you devise a budget, your eye might be off the ball. And, the anger out there across our community is palpable at the moment, and we're heading into a general election. So we want to make sure that the government hear us loud and clear that, we have 280,000 employees in our industry. We've over 20,000 businesses in the hospitality sector, and we're going to voice our opinion. And we want to make sure that the government or whatever political party, we want to see what they're going to do for us in their manifestos ahead of this general election. And it's up to each business owner who they support. But I'll tell you one thing, they'll watch their manifestos very, very clearly. And if they don't see a real and tangible support for small business, they ain't going to support that political party or that independent. So we're making sure that our voice will be well heard ahead of this general election, and we're out to make our voice well known.
Adrian, thank you very much for your time. That's Adrian Cumann, CEO of the Restaurant Association. What's Sinn Féin's plans in respect of the restaurant sector?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's always been clear that Fine Gael are only interested in the large businesses and the multinational corporations. They have a track record and not looking after the small and medium enterprises. And you only have to look at the fact that households and small and medium enterprises have been subsidising the electricity bills of the large energy users for a decade. And that was only unwound after the war in Ukraine, and it just couldn't be defended anymore. We have to tackle it. I mean, I have huge sympathy as someone who likes to go out and eat. I have huge sympathy for restaurateurs because the culture of food in Ireland has been really, really exceptional over the last decade, particularly since the crash. I've seen lots of restaurants setting up doing really interesting stuff. But we have to fix the crux of the problems, which is the housing crisis is putting pressure in terms of wages. You can't get staff in Dublin because people can't afford to live here. The cost of energy, we could be subsidising small and medium enterprises and households. So it could be the reverse. The large energy users could be subsidising them. And then the cost of food as well. We've heard, at the time Neil Richmond called the supermarkets in on the food reductions going and gave them a talking down in opposed to actually doing something about it. So we need to reduce the costs for small businesses.
Now, can I just check?
We also need to have a nightlife. There's a real problem, and it's probably replicated in other big towns. But in Dublin, there is no nightlife.
Particularly
anymore.
In some of our business districts, which follow out come 5 o'clock. The one thing I'm never 100% sure of is the net position. Because if you look, for instance, at Richard Corrigan's restaurant closing, it was immediately reopened by Oliver Dunn in the same location. So to what extent is there a problem with a contraction in the sector, and to what extent do you think is it just normal turnover?
No, I don't think it's just normal turnover. You can see small shops are closing down. Dublin is becoming, a ghost town at night because there's very little nightlife outside of Temple Bar. You then have the situation where small shops are closing and you just have the high street that's the same as every other high street
in
every other European
city. It's just becoming too difficult to stay in business. And actually, there's a great article in the Indo by Lucinda O'Sullivan where she actually shows a chart of the price inflation of basic food pieces, like, chicken fillets have gone up 46% in a couple of years. You know,
which is one of the stock proteins in the country, one of the most popular basic proteins.
Butter portions, 239% increase. So ultimately, it's the consumer who's going to lose out here, because the choice and to be able to consume well, be it through hospitality or through retail, actually, it's becoming, we're actually setting ourselves up for more inflation. The cost of doing business is so great, and that is going to get passed on. For those that survive, the only way they will be able to survive will be to pass those costs on. So ultimately, everybody loses. It was a very short-sighted budget.
Well, that's the thing, though. It is the budget that has been and gone, though. As far as the government parties are concerned, will they say, well, look, that's it. We're focused on the election. This matters not at this point.
I think that would be a very foolish stance. I think this matters an awful lot more than they think.
Lynn, earlier on, Lynn Boylan from Sinn Féin, mentioned Kate O'Connell and the Fine Gael issues to do with her disaffection text, saying, what about Kate O'Connell and the disaffection in Fine Gael and the bad treatment by the party? In case you missed this, this is front page. Fionnuala Sheehan in the Sunday Independent has it, and it's Fine Gael TD Kate O'Connell rejecting an invitation to run for the party. Sorry, former, I should say, Fine Gael TD, rejecting an invitation to come back into the fold. She said she had had decent, robust and fair discussions with Fine Gael, but she has no desire to run as a sweeper for any candidate. And she goes on to say that once bitten, twice shy, bitten multiple times. Yeah, I had always intended contesting the next general election. It's about representing people, and I can do that effectively, she says, best as an independent. And we are on the hunt for Kate O'Connell. Now, one final thing before we wrap up, which is the issue of the Dublin airport passenger cap. You being a law lecturer can explain all of this, Larry Donnelly. Michael O'Leary is saying effectively, aha, gotchas. I've found a way to take you to Europe and make you lift the cap.
Well, he's confident as ever, but he's confident that the legal advice he has is pretty, you know, razor tight, that this is not going to stand up, that is the limitation in passenger numbers. That's one thing. The other interesting development is that evidently the U.S. government is inveighing upon this in terms of the Open Skies Agreement and this potentially being in breach of the Open Skies Agreement.
Now, I'm no lawyer, but just so I understand it, effectively what it boils down to is the planning restrictions limit the amount of people can go through the airport. The Irish Aviation Authority has said, to deliver on that, we're going to limit flights in and out of the airport. And Michael O'Leary is saying, you can't do that because that's in breach of open travel deals in the EU and US.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the long and short of it. But the big thing here is, look, and everyone knows the threat posed by climate change, but this is an island. This is an island that is dependent in many ways upon tourism. The fact that we could lose 1 million visitors is what is being forecast to Ireland as a result of this. I mean, this is really, really terrifying stuff. Yeah. And in terms of, you know, Miriam's points about restaurants and hospitality, et cetera, talk about another death knell that this could represent for them.
What about, regardless of where you stand on whether or not the passenger cap can be removed, I suspect what a lot of people are thinking about this is, this has gone on for months. We're listening to this discussion for months and months and months. Surely there must be a faster way to deal with something that is a matter of such important public policy.
Well, it is a matter of important public policy, but so is planning law. And this is the crux of it. When you have Michael O'Leary saying that the minister should intervene, and I'm never wanted to be on defending the Green Party or any party that's in government, but the minister can't intervene on planning matters. And we have not enough places to even park out of the airport. We have, it's improved in terms of public transport.
But can the minister not intervene in the planning process and find a way to make us able to do these matters of major either infrastructural or economic impact? Make them handle fast.
Well, they've missed an opportunity with the planning bill that they railroaded through last week in the Dáil. There was an opportunity there to reform planning so that you could have faster decisions, absolutely. What they've tried to do is to block people from engaging in that process, which means that we're probably going to see lengthier court cases now, more judicial reviews and actually a slowing down of the planning process. And that's one that we'll just have to wait and see. But that's certainly what the view is of most of the experts who engaged in that planning bill. It's rare that you have a piece of legislation where every stakeholder, bar the government, were saying this is the wrong way to do to reform planning.
There's an article in the Indo, Fergal O'Connor actually saying that there is a likely compromise that's around potentially reducing transit passengers or how passengers arrive. So I'm quite interested to know what that means, you know. So but there is an intimation there. It's quite a vociferous commentary from O'Leary. Shockingly.
I was going to say, it's not often you hear the words compromise and Michael O'Leary.
But it does suggest that there is a compromise on the cards there.
Text say, on the issue of nightlife, I drove through Nace last night with my son and the place was like a ghost town. Compared to a few years back, it would have been jammed with people. This is Lynn's point that Dublin City particularly becomes a ghost. Do you think is that a security issue or is that an economic issue?
Well, I think they all feed into each other. If people don't go out in the city, you don't have that passive surveillance that happens just by people being about, and then more people feel nervous going into the city. So it's just kind of, it feeds itself. And as someone who loved Dublin City, would love to go out and socialise in it. There are parts of the city now that, you know, are pretty bleak in the evening. So we do need to get a crack in this. We need to have a plan, particularly for Dublin. But I think it's probably a problem that you'll see in a lot of town centres or large urban centres.
Lynn Boylan, thank you very much. And likewise, thank you to Larry Donnelly and Miriam Simon. That's Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin MEP for Dublin. Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at the University of Galway, and Miriam Simon.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.